Therefore, Maharaj Pariksit was somewhat surprised The hearing of Maharaj Priya Vrata was simultaneously attached to devotional service and to family life. Devotees are certainly liberated persons. Devotees are certainly liberated persons, therefore, O greatest of the Brahmanas, they cannot possibly be absorbed in a family affair. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Janma karma chane yam evam yoga kitakvataha. Satyadeva devam purna janma naiti mameti soarjana. That one who understands the transcendental appearance and activities of Lord Krishna is liberated. He does not have to take birth again in the material world, but goes to Krishna. Here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada emphasizes the fact that a bhakta, and only a bhakta, can understand Krishna. But the significance of understanding Krishna is that one becomes liberated. So the question is, how could Maharaj Priyavrata, who is a bhakta, and who, as a bhakta, understood Krishna, and who, as a consequence of understanding Krishna, was certainly liberated, how could he be attached to family affairs? Because the two seem contradictory. Then Srila Prabhupada said that one can experience ananda, or bliss, through devotional service. Generally, people marry and have children in order to experience happiness. But real happiness is experienced in Krishna consciousness, not in family life. Certainly not in family life without Krishna consciousness. So, again, there seems to be a contradiction. He was a bhakta, and as a bhakta, he was enjoying the transcendental happiness of Krishna consciousness. So, why would he become involved in family life to become happy when he was already, as a bhakta, happy in Krishna consciousness? Happier than he could be in family life. So these contradictory facts struck Maharaj Pariksit, and therefore he asked Sukadeva Goswami as his spiritual master to resolve a contradiction. Of course, as we will read later, Maharaj Priyavrata did not really want to enter into family life. He had been instructed by his spiritual master, Narada Muni, not to enter into family life. And he himself was very attached to devotional service, and personally, he had no interest in family life. But Priyavrata's father, Manu, he also wanted to pursue his spiritual life. and he wanted his son Priyavrata to take over his duty so he could be free. But Maharaj Priyavrata did not want to. Eventually, Lord Brahma, the original person, father of Manu and grandfather of Priyavrata, came personally and requested Priyavrata to accept the lordship of the kingdom, and along with the service of being the king or emperor, came the obligation to marry, because certain vanas or occupational duties are associated with certain ashrams or stations in life, and to rule a kingdom one must have a wife. It's not appropriate to rule a kingdom as a vanchai. So Maharaj Priyavrata was himself in a dilemma, because Narada Muni had instructed him not to marry, but to devote himself completely to devotional service. And Lord Brahma instructed him to marry. And both were avoided. And Priyavrata could not properly disobey either of the authorities. So he was in a dilemma. And Srila Prabhupada explained in the purport that the disciple should be intelligent enough to adjust apparently contradictory instructions from true authorities, either from the spiritual master and the grand spiritual master. So, of course, that's sort of another topic, but it really answers the question. It's a solid mystery. And that is that Priyavrata did ultimately accept the order of Lord Brahma to marry and rule the kingdom, and thus to free Manu, so that he could enter the next stage of Vanaprastha life and concentrate on his Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, Priyavrata did not neglect the order of his spiritual master, Narada, because he accepted the position of king and husband and father in the mood of service, not in the mood of enjoyment. So this is the real position of a devotee. Whatever position the devotee is in, he accepts the position in a mood of detachment. He doesn't use the position for personal enjoyment, but he uses the position in service to Krishna. Now, ordinarily, people are involved in bhoga and tyaga. Bhoga means material enjoyment, and tyaga means renunciation of material enjoyment. And Srila Prabhupada related an interesting story where he asked a question of his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. Srila Prabhupada often said that he did not have much personal association with his spiritual master, but that he followed the instructions of his spiritual master. Now this is connection. But here Srila Prabhupada gives a little glimpse into his personal relationship with the spiritual master. So he approached Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and said that Rupa Goswami gave up everything for the service of Lord Chaitanya, and therefore he seems to be in the position of Tyaga. And Ramananda Rai, he lived as a householder and as a governor amidst much material opulence, and he seemed to be in the position of Boga. Yet Lord Chaitanya accepted them both equally. They were devoted to Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya accepted them both equally. So what is the position of Boga and Tyaga? Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur replied with the word Rakshakoshika. Rakshakoshika refers to a woman whose husband is away. The Sanskrit term that appears in Usulanilamani. But it applies, of course, in the transcendental realm, but it also applies even in the ordinary world within Vedic culture. That when a woman's husband is away, when he's traveling in some distant land, she will dress herself very plainly. She will lie down and sleep on the floor. She will eat very meagerly. And when people see her, they will know, oh, you know, her husband is away. And the same woman, when her husband returns, she will bathe, she will apply oils to her body, and she will dress very nicely, and she will be very cheerful and lively. So externally, the two positions appear very different. But internally, the central point is always the same. And it's the husband. So, with keeping the husband at the center, when the husband is away, she lives in a very renounced way, you know, in a very austere way. And when the husband is home, you know, she you know, decorates herself and appears to be in the mood of enjoying. But in both cases, the central point is the husband, the pleasure of the husband. So in the same way, Rupa Goswami gave up everything for the service of the Lord. But the central point was the service of the Lord. Similarly, for some time, Ramananda Rai accepted, you know, great material opulence, but also endure the service of the Lord. And therefore, devotees are not interested either in bhoga or in tyaga, but they are only interested in Krishna service. So Maharaj Priyavrata was the same. Although personally he was ready to leave the kingdom and devote himself exclusively to Krishna consciousness, but when the order of the superior came, as a matter of duty, he accepted the position of king. But he never forgot his position of Krishna consciousness, and in the end he did come to the position of Vanaprastha, but he did leave the kingdom and devote himself exclusively to Krishna consciousness. I've seen in my own experience there are rare souls who are like that. There was one very nice devotee in Karachi, Pakistan. Named Anup Bhattacharya. He was, he said he was the only Bengali Brahmin, at least, who remained in West Pakistan. Originally there was just one Pakistan, but then East Pakistan sort of declared itself to be independent of West Pakistan in Bangladesh. So, he was the only one who stayed in West Pakistan. And he was a great devotee. When he was little, growing up in East Pakistan, what is East Pakistan now? Bengal. East Bengal. He used to play in a temple of Mahaprabhu as a child. He didn't know who was Mahaprabhu, but he used to spend time and play in the temple. And it was only so many years later when he met the devotees in Karachi and got Srila Prabhupada's books, immediately wanted all the books. Full set of Srimad Bhagavatam, full set of Chaitanya Charitamrita, that he really understood who is Mahaprabhu. And he was very pure-hearted, very sincere. He had a good position as manager of an import-export company, and he helped us a lot. We didn't have many friends in good positions. There are some Hindus that remain in Pakistan after partition, but they're mostly from. Anyway, that's another story. So he was so enthusiastic for Krishna consciousness and so much relished the association of devotees that Mangaliva Prabhu invited him to move into Adhara Ashram. And I was there for some of the time. Maybe we were a little naive about Grihastha Ashram at the time, and because we were naively advised in a certain way that he should move in with us. And he did, and he was so happy. He would get up and he would sing the prayers and chant, and he would cook. He loved to cook. Uncle Purasti, who made this preparation called Vakra, it's mentioned in Chaitanya Chaitanya. Very simple preparation with 5 or 7 different types of vegetables, but and we were enjoying camping and hearing and discussing, and we would cook and we'd take prasad, and we would have a good time together. But every now and then, there would be a knock on the door, and it would be his wife asking him to come back and saying that, you know, how she was suffering, how the children missed him. And of course, he was supporting them financially to keep his job. And, you know, she would cry and many dramatic scenes, but we sort of, oh, that's just Maya, you know, but eventually it sort of got through to us that this was not right, that much as he was enjoying to stay with us and we were enjoying having him with us, it wasn't right. It wasn't right that she was in such distress and that the children were suffering. So he said, in the end, he said, actually, you should go back. I mean, you still be Krishna conscious and breathe and chant, but you should go back. And he immediately went back. There was no attachment or aversion. You know, when the people he accepted as his authorities told him to move into the ashram, he did it. He thought that was the right thing to do for Krishna consciousness. And when the same authorities told him he should move back with his family, he did it. Because he was convinced that was the best thing for his Krishna consciousness. And eventually, well, the situation in Pakistan deteriorated and he moved to India, to Pune. And in the meantime, I was sort of, well, that was the situation, that I was unable to go back to India because I had visa problems. And consequently, I was spending a lot of time in Pakistan and Sri Lanka and those places. So when he moved to India, I sort of lost touch with him because I couldn't visit India. And fortunately, he came in touch with the Swami Nisaradhanath Swami, the devotees from Chopadi, and took initiation from Radhanath Swami. And so when I did return to India, I met him some years, and he was living with his family in Pune, very devotional, like he always was. And eventually, his wife, who I guess we, you know, in our naivete, we thought she was like my age. Anyway, eventually, she became a devotee. You know, by his patience and care and Krishna consciousness, she became a devotee. She changed around and found him. But then eventually, she got cancer and died. And by then, you know, his children were grown up, and as soon as she left the body, he moved into the temple. Moved into the Chopadi Temple, and he was living, you know, the real Vanaprastha, you know, which was sannyasa, never asked for it. And, but he was really an ideal Vanaprastha, living in the same Buddhist service to the devotees. He loved to cook, sit down and cook for Maharaj. Later, when I was in India, he would cook for me and Maharaj. You know, he was always the first one up in the morning. And they do get up early there, but he was the first one up and cleaned the floor of the temple room and chanted rounds before Mangalai can come down. And then, you know, he just was very Krishna conscious. And then in the end, he also left in a very glorious way. And I was thinking about him, you know, he was a real example. He was kept in both situations. You know, he was very happy in the ashram. When he first asked him to join us, and he went back to his family when he asked him. And he was very beautiful. You know, when he went back, he was very beautiful. He wasn't in the mood that, oh, you know, because of you, I have to leave the temple, or the wood field, you know, the temple. No, he was very beautiful. He was very kind and caring to his family. And at the same time, Krishna conscious. And then later on, when the situation became favorable, he was able to, again, move into the temple. But then he did it having, you know, fully discharged his duties as a Krishna ashram, even to the point of making his wife a devotee, and his children also were, you know, like devotees, but certainly very favorable to Krishna consciousness. And then when he moved into the temple, you know, he could do so with a clear conscience, and everyone understood, yes, now the time has come with everything that he was mentioned for his family. And now the time has come. And, you know, he's been a very wonderful example. So it's, yes, we have the philosophy and the example of great souls from the bottom of the tongue, but it's not that the application of the philosophy is beyond the reach of people like us, people that we can know, and even people that we can aspire to become. It is possible, and that devotion was later initiated as Adhiram Thakur, a good example, an inspiration. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Are there any questions or comments?
When we were talking about Mike Pritchett asking the question about Priyavrata, he was similar also to Mike Pritchett because special circumstance. The Lord protected him, and he was in the womb of Uddha. I don't know his whole life story, but he was also very special like that. And, family member of fathers and all through the Lord's family like that.
Yeah, that's true.
He was very detached because he didn't have to accept that curse. He could have lived longer, but he accepted the curse, he was going to die, and he could have avoided it. Mm.
Very good point of Chaitanya Chandraprabhu made that Maharaj Pariksha was also special, like Maharaj Priyavrata, because from within the womb he was protected by Lord Krishna, and from then on he was always looking for that person who had protected him, so he was looking for God, the Krishna. And in his childhood he would play with deities. From the very beginning he was Krishna conscious. But again, for the sake of service, as a matter of duty, he accepted the position of king. But he wasn't attached, and therefore when he was cursed by the young Brahmin boy, although he could have counteracted the curse, he chose not to. He took it as Krishna's mercy, so that he could move on to his next position of service. Very good point. Yes.
Maharaj, I hope I can clearly ask this question. When you were in Grahastha life, when you were supposed to be acting in the mode of service, Solomon seeing that the relationship would possibly become superficial with his family, just because Solomon seems to need to be attached, but you're not attached at the same time. And that would create a conflict, which would actually cause the relationship to become superficial, because at all times of time, you think you're doing it as service. But at the same time, you need to have certain levels of attachment, attachment that's still a job, to be able to serve properly in that aspect. That's a difficult, don't understand when you say that there actually needs to be in the mood of service. But the superficiality in that relationship then would cause possible problems too.
That's a good point, that if one is too detached in the relationship, if he has to act on it just in the mood of service and duty, then the relationship will be sort of superficial, and therefore it might not work. Well, that is a good point, and you've touched on the subtlety that that I didn't today, but brought up, and that is that when Maharaj Priyavrata did, you know, accept the position of king and husband, he very much identified with the role, and it's described that he and his wife enjoyed celestial happiness together, and that in a way he forgot his earlier determination of Krishna consciousness, and later on it came back to him. One could say it's all the arrangement of the Lord, but in the end he came back to him, and he started to defend himself, oh, I just really was an ordinary person, and, you know, fought on you, you know, I should regain my original position of Krishna consciousness. So there's truth to what you said. Once a disciple had Srila Prabhupada Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but so many children. And Srila Prabhupada implied that when they would read Krishna sort of infused Bhaktivinoda Thakur with the mode of passion, when there was need. And when the need was fulfilled, Krishna sort of withdrew the mode of passion. So you're right. You're right. It can't be just like a clinical thing without any emotion that, oh, you know. You're right. I'll just add one more point to this, and that is, you know, the idea that a devotee is a devotee, but at the same time is a human. And here, there was a newspaper publisher in Mauritius who asked Srila Prabhupada to sort of disdainful mood towards Arjuna, that Arjuna had heard the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, that he even told Krishna that he understood what Krishna had taught him, but still when he received the news that his sons had been killed, he was overwhelmed with grief and he was ready to enter into fire. So So the editor, Mr. Rambala, was saying, you know, isn't it ridiculous to be interviewed directly from Krishna? He told Krishna, I have understood what you've said. But in the end, when he heard that his son had been killed, he became overwhelmed with grief. And Srila Prabhupada replied that, that yes, the Bhagavad Gita says, you know, Nahanyate Hanyamani Shunyate, that when the mind dies, the soul does not die. But Srila Prabhupada says, yes, we all know that. In theory, we all know that. But when, you know, we lose a loved one, we cry. And he said, that's natural. He said, everyone does that. But he said, you know, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna to convince him to fight. And even though he lamented for the loss of his children, which Srila Prabhupada said was natural, but in the end he didn't give up his duty. He still fought. And therefore, you know, he was a success. He did follow the instruction of Krishna and Bhagavad Gita. So there Srila Prabhupada sort of gives the hint that, yes, as a devotee, he was surrendered to the order of Krishna, and in the end he fought as he was ordered. But as a human being, you know, he had the same emotions that human beings have when a family member or other loved one died. And but Srila Prabhupada didn't consider those human emotions to be to affect Arjuna's position as a pure devotee, because in the end, Arjuna did follow the order of Krishna, and he gave up his duty because of his emotional or setback in life.
Concerning the whole interaction of the devotees with the ordinary material world, sometimes we get discussions about social issues and people, you know, pose questions how we feel about certain issues in the news and so forth. We were discussing. One of our guests and I were discussing same-sex marriage, and I expressed the opinion that I didn't think it was such a great leap forward for civilization of men that now marrying man. Now this person posed the question, why are you so concerned about who marries who, or illicit sex in general, or meeting or gambling when corporations are clear-cutting entire mountainsides and so forth, and polluting the atmosphere. These are the real sins of our society, and why should you give such a narrow interpretation to the sin of morality?
That's a good question. but we don't. Well, first of all, there's two parts to the question. One is, why do we give so much emphasis to the regulative principles when there are people doing much worse to the world and to the environment? And then the second is, as you presented it, is why do we give such a narrow definition to sin? Well, as far as the second point, we actually don't give such a narrow definition. We do consider it simple to cut trees for sense gratification.
Yes.
We use paper to publish books about Krishna consciousness, and that's the only justification, really, for cutting trees, and that is to use them in relation to devotional service. But otherwise, cutting trees is sinful. It's killing. But these are the pillars of sinful life. They're not the only sins, but they're the pillars, they're the basis of sinful life. Now, as far as why we give so much emphasis to them, of course, our main emphasis is on chanting. We give much more emphasis to chanting than to the regulative principles. But for the chanting to have full effect, one should also follow the regulative principles. Now, if the person may question, well, you know, what does this have to do with the world? How is it going to help the world? Well, it will help the world, because why do people do all those things? Why do they exploit material nature? Why are they ruining the planet, you know, so that they can exploit the material nature? For sense gratification, they want to make money for sense gratification. Or, to reduce it to an even more simple principle, they do it because their minds are polluted. So the chanting, especially accompanied by following the regulative principles, cleanses the mind. Shake it up in the mind. And when the mind is purified, then they won't, you know, exploit other people, they won't exploit the animals, they won't exploit the environment for their uncontrolled desires for material sense gratification. Just like we, and that's what Prabhupada always said, that we don't make a point of preaching non-violence or vegetarianism, but if someone becomes a devotee, he or she will automatically become vegetarian and non-violent. So that's the idea, that you can tell them it's bad to, you know, destroy the forest, or it's bad to pollute the waters, or all the horrible things they're doing for their sense gratification, but just telling them that won't change them, because their consciousness is contaminated. They're full of lust and greed. But if their consciousness is purified by chanting, and especially chanting in the context of following the regulative principles, then the result will be they won't do that anymore. They won't be completely motivated by lust and greed. But when their consciousness is purified, then their actions will be clear. That the horrors in the world are just a manifestation of the horrors in people's consciousness. If their consciousness becomes rectified by Krishna consciousness, then their behavior will be rectified automatically.
Along with that, I was reading Queen Kunti's prayer, and she said in part of the prayer that distinction is due to social intercourse, and the purport of Prabhupada mentioned that because of people, like you think you're saying, desires for sense gratification, that they exploit one another, and this is what causes the karmic reaction, is that people's desires to exploit, they act in some way to exploit another person that causes the reaction to this. Is the karma. So the realization they have is that the Bhagavatam, the Vaishnava culture, teaches people how to respect every living entity, how to respect the woman as mother, that exploit the woman for a sense of gratification. It teaches how to respect everything as a part and parcel of the Lord, and the Lord in everybody's heart. The whole culture of Krishna consciousness, of the Bhagavad philosophy, is to understand things in a different way. Mm-hmm. It gives people an alternate way of thinking. So when you become purified, you have the whole combination of the philosophy of the respect of the Vaishnava culture and the Bhagavad philosophy, then that provides people the alternative to think. Also, I was thinking like that, mm-hmm. some social intercourse, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, this thought is something else. This is, I didn't give it to you when you asked the question, but again, once the Swami Nityananda Swami ended up on his flight in India sitting next to Menaka Gandhi. Menaka Gandhi was the widow of Sanjay Gandhi, and she became sort of like an activist herself in India. And she's like really into the environment. And she asked a similar question to Radhana Swami, that, you know, are you getting people to chant and so on, but how, you know, what are you doing for the world? What are you doing for the environment? And, you know, Maharaj gave the same type of answer that when people's consciousness is purified, then, you know, the behavior will be better. As long as their consciousness is polluted, they'll continue to pollute the environment. And she liked it. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Jai Gaura
Prabhupada,
Jai Gaura Prabhupada, Jai Gaura Prabhupada, Jai Gaura Prabhupada.